Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. Our guest on the program is author Janice Mitchell. Her brand new book is called My Ticket to Ride, How I Ran Away to England to Meet the Beatles and Got Rock and Roll Banned in Cleveland. She has some pretty interesting adventures for a 16-year-old. Literally, she just thought she'd leave boring, terrible Cleveland and go to London and hang out with the Beatles. Didn't quite work out that way. We'll hear the whole story in this interview as we listen to Enoch Light's version here of I Want to Hold Your Hand in the background. I definitely Meet the Beatles was the first album that I can remember visually connecting to. I know what the cover looks like at probably age five or so, and started to learn the songs, you know, from that record. I still have my mother's copy of that record. It has yellow mustaches graffitied over all four Beatles on the cover. I think handiwork of my brother. But I still treasure the sort of scratchy way that record sounds to me. It means Beatles to me. I sometimes take that out when I'm DJing in a live situation, and there's just something very exciting about that way that LP sounds to me, and obviously a few grillion other people. So, interesting first-person story here from 1964, Janice Mitchell. Her new book is called My Ticket to Ride. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you're well. Hope you're vaccinated. And hope all this ends soon. Talk to me, Michael S. at WFMU.org. That's my email. Archives over at WFMU.org/Michael. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Okay, Janice Mitchell, the author of My Ticket to Ride, How I Ran Away to Meet the Beatles and Got Rock and Roll Banned in Cleveland, joins us. Good morning, Janice. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
Terrific. I really enjoyed the book. It's so interesting to get a firsthand information about this time, such an interesting time. The book starts 1963 when you hear I Want to Hold Your Hand on the radio on WHK in Cleveland. Tell me a minute, because you talk about this in the book, and I think this is very interesting. Tell me a little bit about what the radio was like before Beatles music. I think in the book you say tame.
Tame, yes. When I tell you that a song that I'm sure the nuns loved very much, a song called Dominique, which was sung by the singing nun on an acoustic guitar in French, had hit number one on the Billboard. That might tell you a little, will give you a little indication of what we were listening to in those days. But even like the liveliest songs, songs we could dance to, really didn't hit you in any particular way like the Beatles did. You know, it was just, this is what it is, and we danced and we had fun. We didn't know anything different. So it was very interesting, the contrast when the Beatles came on. It was night and day.
Yeah, that's a super interesting literal turning point in history. So it's December 1963, I Want to Hold Your Hand comes on the radio. And I do want to give some background in a nutshell, because to me it's so important what follows. The book really paints a picture of you in what I would call a sort of a terrible childhood. Your parents were more interested in drinking and partying than in you and your siblings. They, you know, they couldn't hold down jobs. They were starting fires. They were dropping you off with strangers so they could go out. And so you go to live with your aunt and her husband. She was kind of strict. You loved him. And you're in Catholic school, and no one is nice to you. No one is loving and nurturing to you. And I think that really sets up, you know, this longing that you had, this need that you had, and that kind of sets up what happens in the book. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with it. And the other part that of my childhood that kind of sets things up for me is because of my parents' abandonment all the time. They were not home a lot. Any money that they had was going towards alcohol and cigarettes and partying. So we were just left at home many times with no one there. And a lot of times there literally was no food, and no one really cared about that. And I remember finding little toys around the apartment and thinking I could sell this for a nickel, and then I could go and buy a candy bar for me and my sister. Literally no food, not just candy for fun, but a little kid, age 5 or 6, could buy a candy bar. And so that's what I was doing, and also trying to escape the physical abuse of both my parents. So I learned to be pretty quick on my feet, and I learned to be a little survivor from the very beginning, like find my way, you know, get out of there, hide. So I became really good, you know, at surviving on my own, you know, and dodging, you know, the bad stuff that was going on at the house. So I was always, I learned to be an independent thinker very early on. And I think that, you know, that's what really contributed to the kind of, teenager and adult, you know, that I became.
In the book, like, you say that the Beatles music gave you something to live for. As a grown-up adult now, does that seem, is that a logical idea to you, or was that a sort of a teenage, you know, you were kind of projecting this world that you could live in through the Beatles music?
Well, that's the mind of a teenager, you know. You don't see very far in front of you, and you can't really gauge what's happening or, you know, what your future might be. And I was raised Catholic, so fortunately that really helped me a lot, because I could always go over to church. And, you know, we were taught that, you know, when you die, you're going to go to heaven, you know, and Jesus was everything. So that was pretty much bedrock, you know, as part of I was growing up. But when I felt so energized and transformed, suddenly the whole world kind of opened up to me in so many ways. And I did feel like, oh, now there's something to live for. Not that I was feeling like there wasn't anything to live for. It's just I could see, you know, a light. I could see a light, you know, a brightness.
Eventually you start earning a little money, and you save and you buy yourself a record player. And there's a point in the book where you and your friend Marty and almost everyone around you become Beatle obsessed. And it's just kind of, how long did that take to happen? And just tell me, you know, how it manifested itself.
That was immediate. As soon as the Beatles were on the radio, everybody that I knew, kids, were affected. And even the nuns at school liked the Beatles. Yeah, so that's serious, right? So because we had to know everything about them, and at that, in those days, there was no other way other than buying records, buying teen magazines or Beatle magazines, buying bubblegum cards, and making up your own little stories. And then we were now living for when they were going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th. 1964. That would be our very first chance to actually see them as living beings on a little tiny screen, moving around and playing their music. So that would be our first chance.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that in the book you talk about how some people rejected the idea of the Beatles, and I can understand not having them be to your taste, especially for the older generation. But in the book, there's even examples of folks saying that they weren't talented or that they were ugly or things that are just sort of counterfactual. And it makes me wonder, from your point of view, are those people who were just, who really felt that, or were they just so scared of change that they were, that it was their anger or their ego talking about, or they felt their own lives being marginalized? And, you know, what was that about, you think?
Well, at the time, I mean, we just rejected anything negative that anybody could possibly say about the Beatles. Those were just considered people that were ridiculous. So why they felt that way, you know, I had no idea at the time. I didn't care. It didn't matter. You know, I just had to have everything about the Beatles. So, but as I look back, I think, well, you know, they really made such tremendous impact, and it's the first real impact in people's lives, and I think that people automatically, you know, reject something like that. If they can't feel it themselves, if they're not a part of it, they're just going to reject it.
That's interesting. So you're music obsessed, and somehow you befriend this guy named Harry Martin, who is a DJ at KYW Radio. And long, long story short, he sort of gets you in to see a Mike Douglas show taping where the Rolling Stones are the musical guest. Long story short, you end up hanging out backstage with them and sort of becoming friendly with Bill Wyman. In a nutshell, tell us what happened.
Well, in a nutshell, so I was in the studio waiting for the Rolling Stones show to start. And I was asked to leave because I didn't have a ticket. I said, well, Harry Martin brought me in here. And the man, I guess he was like a security guard, he said, well, I don't care who brought you in here. If you don't have a ticket, you're out. He opened the door for me to leave. And that was it. The door closed behind me. And so I just stood there thinking to myself, not even really thinking, just knowing that I was not leaving. And I just happened to see a door with a doorknob. I propelled myself over there, turned the knob, pulled the door. It opened. I walked in. The door closed behind me. And I'm walking down a hallway. And I realized that I'm backstage at the Mike Douglas show. So as you say, long story short, a little man ran up to me and asked me if I was going to be on the show today. And I said, yes. And he said, let me show you where your dressing rooms are. And he pointed me to a hallway. And I'm walking down the hallway, thinking it's all still all over. I get to the end. I turn to the left, look in one of the dressing rooms, and there's Bill Wyman sitting there with his guitar, and he invites me in to sit next to him. So I'm paralyzed, and I can barely speak, of course. I just obey, you know? And I look, and there's Mick Jagger. He had put a chair on top of a desk, and he was sitting on that chair. And there was Keith Richards with his guitar, and Charlie Watts, rest in peace, tapping his drumsticks, and Brian Jones, looking every bit in a lost angel. So it wound up that Bill said, well, we're going to be taken out of the room shortly to do to record our interview for the radio station, but you stay here. And if anybody wants to know who you are, just say you're with us. And I thought, wow, okay. So they leave. Shortly thereafter, a man opens the door and he says, well, who are you? And I said, I'm with the Stones. And he said, okay, well, don't leave. Don't walk out because you may not get back in. He leaves and I'm thinking, I can't believe that really worked. So anyway, the Stones all come back and now it's time for them to go on the Mike Douglas, perform on Mike Douglas. And Bill says to all of the boys, remember, she's with us. And they all repeat that. And we're meeting now Mike Douglas. And Mike says, he's saying hello to all the boys. And he says, well, who is this? And they all say, she's with us. What a magical moment. So they perform. The show is over. This was their first tour in America. And they were on a bus tour. And Bill Wyman, as they're walking out, he takes my hand and he says, come with me. So I was just astounded, and I'm thinking, well, I can't because I already have this much bigger plan, and which I'm not going to give up anything for that. So I tell him that I can't go, and he actually kisses me right on the lips, and then he leaves with the rest of them.
This is kind of a weird question, but Bill Wyman, notorious hooker-upper with groupies, right? This is like and I think he kept diaries and notes about all of it. In some ways, I guess there's worse things to have, you know, an encounter, a sexual encounter with Bill Wyman when you are a rock-obsessed teenage girl. But looking back on it, do you regret not maybe just going and doing that, or are you thrilled to death that you did not do that?
I'm certainly very glad I did not do that at that time. Now, that would have really ruined things for me.
Okay. So you had this idea, you had read in these magazines that the Beatles hung out in clubs in the Soho section of London. So at some point you thought, well, if I go to the Soho section of London, I will meet the Beatles. It was simply, am I right that it was just that simple for you?
It was that simple. And I thought, oh my gosh, how could they even print something like that? So I tell my friend, look at this. Now we know where they go.
So you guys start planning. You've got a very meager savings, but your friend Marty closes out her college fund. I think it's about $1,900. You get tickets. You get passports. In reading the book, I sort of get the feeling that you weren't particularly afraid or worried. You just were sort of moving forward. Or were you worried?
Not really. I made my plan. I was on my way to live forever in what I called Beetle Land, where life obviously had to be very happy, because that's where the Beatles came from, and that's where they, you know, made their music. So they must be reflecting what life is like there, and I wanted to be a part of it.
It's such a wonderful teenage ideal, thought to have. So meanwhile, the Beatles come to Cleveland's public hall, and there were 10,000 postcards sent to a lottery for 100,000 postcards for the 10,000 seats, and you end up with front row center seats for, I should point out, $6.50 each. Tell me, how was the show?
Well, first of all, it was very loud. I was not the type of girl who would jump up and down and scream or go crazy. That just was not what I did. But as the Beatles, this was going to be the first time that I would ever see them live in front of me. The front row was 10 feet from the stage. And, you know, there they were. And all these kids were screaming, crying, yelling, you know, waving signs and everything back and forth. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the third song, they start rushing down the aisles, and it was just total pandemonium to the point where the police shut the show down and threatened to close it. And that's where Harry Martin, my DJ friend, and Specs Howard, he was also part of the Howard and Martin morning show duo, came out on the stage and helped to get the crowd settled down. So even though everybody kind of settled down, they took their seats for the most part, you still couldn't hear a single word that they were, you couldn't hear anything, nothing. So just to be there in their presence, you know, and be able to know all the words to every song they're singing, you know, was really enough.
But just to check, your expectations before you entered there, you thought it would just be a concert. You'd all sit and watch the songs and applaud after them.
That's what I expected. I expected everybody to behave themselves.
Wow. Okay. So the next day, which is September 1964, and I should point out that you are a 16-year-old junior in high school, which is my exact daughter's age, you guys head off to London. You start in a hotel. Eventually, you rent an apartment, and you start going out to coffee houses and clubs, hoping to run into the Beatles. You get some attention from boys. You guys don't have a ton of money, but you seem to very quickly have a kind of a very sweet little life there, meeting boys, you know, going out, traveling around. Meanwhile, in the United States, this is becoming a giant story, and in the UK as well. There's headlines, and your book reprints a lot of these newspaper stories, you know, every day, you know, girls missing, you know, and then they sort of figure out that you went to London and they're looking for you. They're running stories on the radio, you know, personal appeals for you to call in because they figured you'd be listening to the radio. Am I right that you had no idea that this attention was happening while you were just going around to coffee houses and stuff?
No idea whatsoever, because we didn't watch, we didn't have a TV in our flat. We didn't have a radio. And of course, we didn't have a record player. We didn't read newspapers. We didn't do any of that stuff. We were just living the life we wanted to live, you know, hanging out with like incredible boys, you know, who are also musicians, and we were a part of the scene. And, that's all I really needed. I didn't care to do any of those other things. So I had no idea that anybody was looking for me whatsoever.
I should point out, too, that it was not illegal for you and Marty as 16-year-olds to go and do everything that you did. I guess skipping school is against the rules. But just going there, there were no rules against it. Yet people were sort of... well, as we'll find out later, people didn't exactly treat you like you had done nothing. So you're walking around, and one day a Bobby recognizes you because all the police have been sort of put on the lookout for you. It seems amazing. Why? I mean, I assume excuse me, I assume that there are, you know, millions of teenage girls walking around the streets of London. How did he know that you were that girl? Did he just memorize your face?
I don't know. I wish I knew. I didn't even know until, you know, he suggested we go to the police station, you know, just to make sure that I was or was not that girl. And as, when we walked in, he pointed up to the photographs, the missing girls photographs up there, huge. And that's when I realized, when we were walking down Oxford Street and he said that I seemed to resemble one of them. That's when it struck me, oh my gosh, they have pictures. I didn't know. But I learned from newspaper stories much later on that the local police department, you know, had engaged the help of the State Department and Scotland Yard to begin searching for us. And they had circulated our photos widely in this daily police blotter that every police station got. And also I learned that the police there had formed a pool where they each officer put money in this pool. And the first one who would find us, they would get all that money. So they were motivated.
It is sort of sad that you really, I mean, is this right that you really did not think your aunt would report you missing or try to get the police and folks looking for you?
Well, in my naive teenage mind, I assumed she would be happy that I would be gone, that she wouldn't have to bother with me anymore. Wow. That was really my thought.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's real sad. So eventually the folks take you to the police station where they treat you very well, and then to the American embassy where you give a press conference, and then they basically throw you on a plane back to JFK. And one of the things you make real plain in the book is that the way the American authorities treated you versus the way the British authorities treated you only emphasized your desire to go back and live in this kind of mythical, wonderful Beatle land because folks were kind of harsh to you once you were in the hands of Americans.
It was shocking. The difference was just so shocking because in London, the police were very nice to us and they were happy. I remember one of the police officers at the police station, he said, oh, you know, we're so happy to have you two Beatle girls here. We hardly ever get VIPs, you know?
You're celebrities.
Yeah, we were celebrities there. Yeah.
You end up literally in juvie. You end up spending some time in juvenile detention. And it was interesting because there were some people that had respect for what you did. I think you got mail from kids. You know, what did those letters say?
Well, I was not allowed to see those letters. Only one letter was I permitted to see. I don't know why, but it was from a couple in Japan who wanted us to know that they were so happy, you know, about what we did because most people don't follow their dreams, but we did. So they wanted us to know about that. And then I heard about other mail, that fan mail. I couldn't believe we had fan mail from kids all across the country and even Canada, wanting to know exactly how we did what we did so they could follow what we did and do it themselves.
I guess that's why they didn't want you to see the stuff. And it's interesting, the way you get treated, like I said, some people kind of, you know, you were a hero or an anti-hero, but some people also just resented your celebrity status or just, like we said earlier, some people just don't like folks who do something different. And you did take sort of some heat. Eventually, and I do point out that the book is called, the subtitle of the book is How I Ran Away to Meet the Beatles and I Got Rock and Roll Banned in Cleveland. Eventually, they did ban the Beatles or other groups like that from playing in any public halls in Cleveland, which is sort of hysterical in retrospect.
Yeah, really hysterical. Well, because when we had to go to juvenile court, the juvenile court judge, he made sure that he was assigned to this particular case. And he made sure that the jury box was full of newspaper reporters, of course, all men at the time. so that he could make a statement about the evils of rock and roll music and how any parent who did not accompany their child to that Beatles concert should hang their heads in shame, and how we had just been, you know, law-abiding citizens before this music changed us. So he had a lot of stern things to say about that. And then we were forbidden from attending any concerts. And the very next day, the mayor of Cleveland, backed it all up by saying that this kind of music did not serve the community. And therefore, Beatles music and rock and roll was banned in Cleveland. And that was that. And I felt so responsible. That was a heavy thing to carry on my back. And that's another reason why I felt like I can't really talk about this, because look at what I've done.
Sometimes when you're a kid, folks say stuff like, you will understand this when you're older. But I assume at that time you thought, no, I'm right and I'll always be right. And in retrospect, you're still right. Or did you question your own choices?
Well, I never questioned what I did, because that's what I wanted to do. That's what I was happy to do. And I planned to stay in England forever, never planned to leave. So it was just a shame that I got nabbed and brought back here.
Yeah, I guess it was going to happen. Janice Mitchell has been our guest. My Ticket to Ride, How I Ran Away to Meet the Beatles and Got Rock and Roll Banned in Cleveland is the book. It's just been released. I wish you the best of luck with it. Do you still get a thrill now when you hear I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the song that, you know, was so dear to my heart. It's like an old friend, you know, being with an old friend when I hear that song. And it's one of the most perfect songs, one of the most perfect Beatles songs, in my opinion, ever written. So, yeah, I love it always.
Yeah, no disagreement from me. Let's hear it now. Janice, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Baby.